Blog Talk Radio.
From the directors of Reservoir Dogs, Desperado, Pulp Fiction, From Dusk Till Dawn, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, Kill Bill, and Sin City, Tarantino and Rodriguez are back. Only this time, they're back to back with a double feature that'll tear you in two. First,
I got bit.
Bit by what?
If I told you, you probably wouldn't believe me.
Robert Rodriguez, Planet Terror.
Made you something. Open that door, will you, baby?
Plus,
fair lady,
your chariot awaits.
Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof.
Do I frighten you? Is it my scar?
Two no holds barred feature length motion pictures for the price of one. Planet Terror and Death Proof. Only at the Grindhouse.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound. Look, up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane.
No, it's Max, Darrow, and D-Bert, your host for the Comic Shop Show.
Let me clear my throat there. Folks, welcome once again. This is Grindhouse, Afro Nerd Radio style. Afro Nerd Radio presents our version of Grindhouse. Listen, folks, we got a two-hour, fully packed, fully functional show. We have, of course, the indefatigable, the irascible, the incredible, as Incredible Hulk, Incredible Darryl being, of course, Captain Kirk. We got a lot to get into, folks. Let's just get into a quick jammy jam, a quick groove. This is a redo for the Saturday morning crew of the Fat Albert theme. Let's groove to Fat Albert for about 2 minutes, and we'll be right back to comic book pulp discourse. Hold on, folks. Let's groove. Again, that was a group called Dig, the Fat Albert theme from Saturday Morning Cartoons Redo. Okay, folks, we're back once again, Sunday, the 23rd of September. Time is moving along, and I could not do the show, not effectively anyway, without my crew, our own Starship Enterprise crew. First up, Captain Kirk, you need it. Let's get into it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And then, of course, Daryl B.
And who knew that talking to an empty chair would hurt you with women the moviegoers? Sorry, Clint.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that movie came out this weekend, right, Daryl?
Yep, and it bombed.
Wow.
It was the only thing that did kind of worse than it was Dread 3D, unfortunately.
We're going to talk about that, by the way. Wow, you know, I was rooting for Clint in a way. I mean, I learned to separate what his performance, I put that in quotes, his performance in the Republican National Convention a few weeks ago. I'm trying to separate the two, but he did come off like a doddering old fool. And I was hoping that the public would separate that from him being a stellar filmmaker, but it looks like I thought, he was so bad during that performance that people probably say, you know what, I really don't want to support this guy. Sometimes that's why there's wisdom in leaving politics alone if you're going to be an artist. You've got to be very careful with that balancing act. All right, gentlemen, again, folks, you're listening to The Comic Shop, Grind, our version of Grindhouse Sundays, a double feature. The Comic Shop show at 6 p.m., of course, and Afternerd Radio, a.k.a. Afternerd featuring Captain Kirk at 7 p.m., where we will be interviewing author and music journalist Lena Dawes. Lena Dawes, regarding her experience with the heavy metal scene. She has a new book, Why Are You Here? So it should be pretty eventful as to why she explains how she came about being a heavy metal head as a woman of color. That's coming up at 7 p.m. All right, gentlemen, we're all going to talk about all things pulp and also politics in a way. Daryl, you sent me an email regarding Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman and the innocence of Muslims. Go into that a little bit. How does Neil Gaiman work himself into the middle of this Islamic hoopla? You know, I'm pretty sure our folks are aware that there's a reversal on the Arab Spring with people attacking American embassies, all because of this horrible, horrible YouTube film entitled Innocence of Muslims. Somehow the great Neil Gaiman is involved in this somehow. Explain that for
the
audience.
Essentially what it is one of the actresses that was in this thing, Anna Gurry, and apologies if I got her name wrong there, but she and Gaiman had a relationship, not like a professional relationship. They met each other. She's a big Neil Gaiman fan, all right? So here it is. She does this film called The Desert Warrior, all right? And she's thinking, I'm doing this. It's about an artifact falling into the desert and all these groups fighting each other to recover said artifact. That's what it was supposed to. There was no religion involved, okay? There was no mention of Muhammad. There was nothing, according to her account, okay? Then she sees the film she thought she was doing get released on YouTube as this clip, which is causing all the violence. Well, I'll get back to that in a second. So she was very troubled by it. She reached out to Gaiman and voiced her concerns, and Gaiman went, you know what? You send me what you got. Essentially, you send me the truth as you know it, and I will put it up on my site, and I'll make sure everybody sees it. And everybody knows Neil Gaiman has a large followership, all right, online, on movies, books. There's a lot of people that follow him. So he put up her account, and what it leads you to believe, or at least what, in my opinion, okay, because belief here, it gets very, very stretched, okay, is that this actress went out for one thing, and through manipulative hands, this thing was edited, cut, spliced in different ways, so for anti-Islamic groups, or persons, or people unknown, to voice their message. to make fun of the Islamic religion and all of that, okay? And the problem is, when you do something like that nowadays, especially with the internet, other groups could take what you did and use it as a rally cry to force the dissent, to get people's ire up, to get things, and that's what led to some anti-American groups over there got a hold of it, went, yo, let's put it out. Let's get the people worked up. As a result, we have an ambassador dead, 4 Marines dead, and at least 20 people, and unfortunately that death toll is rising. It just goes to show, when you manipulate information, when you lie, and you're deceitful, there are unforeseen consequences, and we're all paying right now.
So now Neil Gaiman's involved in this thing, as you stated, because of this professional relationship. But you also forwarded a letter to my attention. This is from Neil Gaiman's website.
Yeah.
Where the letter is submitted as proof positive as to what was going on with her. Now, the interesting thing that makes this, I guess, an Afro-nerd discussion or a comic shop discussion is that she thought she was acting in a sci-fi flick or a sci-fi fantasy flick. Then the names were changed to protect the guilty, more or less,
or the
innocent in her case.
Yeah, and not even the names, the whole tone of the picture because of how they cut it was changed up, and think about it. She comes from Georgia, of the formerly Soviet Union, right? She says she was raised in a household that preached tolerance of all religions, that preached, you know, everybody's equal, you know, all of that. And now imagine you see yourself in this thing mocking another religion and then hearing about people dying because of that. I can't imagine what this young woman's going through.
Well, Captain, I want you to comment on this briefly because, see, one of the issues on this that makes it really horrifying is that because these are theocracies overseas, these Islamic nations, the populace, Everything that they do, even electronically, is monitored by the state, monitored or authorized by the state. They can't do anything unless the government approves of it. So they can't fathom that anybody, that we have such freedom in this country, that essentially anyone can post a clip on YouTube. They can't fathom that clip could go out without government approval. I mean, people put up all kinds of goofy clips. Even as we speak, literally thousands of clips are going on YouTube and all these other sites that are similar to YouTube without discretion. I mean, it's the way it is. They can't fathom that, so they think that this is a state-sanctioned thing, and this is why they're causing holy hell with these American embassies over there. So I'm asking you, Captain, this letter that she has, that Neil Gaiman has on his website, she's trying to explain this thing. Do you think these fundamentalists are going to accept this? She has a fatwa overhead right now. What are your thoughts?
Well, I there's a few things going on here. First, definitely when you make a movie, you roll up as an actress or actor, it can be broken down and switched around, can be dubbed, things changed around, cut, edited in a different manner, and it can become a different movie. It happens. I even seen it with a video. I remember years ago being on a video shoot with Ray Benzino, and I was there at the video shoot now. And then when I saw that what was edited, I said, that wasn't the video we shot. It was something entirely different. Something entirely different. And I was actually pissed off. So I was like, so that definitely can happen. It definitely can happen. Not just for a video, you know, that's going to be aired on, you know, MTV, no, BET, Late Night Uncut. So it definitely can happen. So that's number one. Number two, when you start to look at all the evidence that's coming out from this right now, it's starting to look a little sketchy. And I hate when things are starting to look sketchy because they make everything seem like those Muslims, you just throw them a little meat in their cage, and then they go crazy. That's what they make it seem like at all times. But when you start to look at all the evidence that comes out from behind this, it looks like it's possible. It's possible the whole situation could be a false flag situation, because right now, look what's happening. If you look at everything, not to go off on a tangent, but it's tangentially related. If you look at everything, you need the diplomatic and the political format to go do something that you need to do. You need the run-up. All of this looks like a very nice run-up before you go do whatever you want to do. But even though there is a reversal, which is good, because we don't want anything like that. We don't want any type of war. We don't want anything going on. But you need certain things in a line in order for the American people and the rest of the world to say, all right, go do what you ever want, you want to go do with these Muslim people. It's just starting to look sketchy. I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but it's starting to look very sketchy at this given point when you start to look at all the evidence. You have to be very careful with this type of thing at this given time. This looks very sketchy to me. Back over to you, Sir Apple Nerd.
All right. Well, we're going to have to do a quick transition, probably one of the few times we talk seriously. But listen, one of the honor guard in the comic book world, Neil Gaiman, it makes it interesting to talk about that he's in the middle of it somewhat. Again, it appears he's trying to vouch for this actress. I hope it works out for her. But, you know, Salman Rushdie, a famed author within his own right, the Satanic, what is it, Satanic Verses, I believe, was hallmark work. He had a fatwa on his head for 10 years, you know, so by the Ayatollah Khomeini years back. So he has a book out now that I'm going to buy that talks about his experiences. It was almost comical in a way if it wasn't so serious. He says if it wasn't so serious, it would be funny about how he had to go into hiding. And now this young lady, she's in hiding as well just by being connected to this horrible film. I mean, it's horrible because of the content. But it's horrible because it's just a lousy film. It's just lousy. So my prayers go out to them. I hope it gets resolved, but do not mess with those Muslims. That's why I'm just put it that way. That's my word of advice for the day. All right, gentlemen, again, we'll go to a musical break in a moment, but I do want to get to more pulp-flavored talk. Judge Dredd came out this week. I think it's at $6.3 million as a takedown, $50 million budget. Not looking too well. At End of Watch, which only cost $7 million, has a $7 million budget, already grossed $13 million. That's number one this week. That's a Jake Gyllenhaal and Michael Peña police drama. That looks, to be honest with you, it looks interesting anyway. It looks like an interesting movie. What's the deal? I didn't see Dredd. I guess I will get around to it. Daryl, did you see Judge Dredd?
Yeah, I actually saw both movies.
What are your thoughts on this thing? Is it? I'm hearing it's not that bad. Our friend from the UK, Stanley Kubrick, said it's not that bad. But there's some things going on with it, though. What can you tell us about it?
You know what it is? It's for all those guys who say that. You remember before this, during the beginning of the summer, is superheroes or superhero and comic related movies taking over Hollywood? Da da da. It just goes to show that you don't know. Fans are fickle. Remember, I brought up last week how in England there were glowing reviews for this. There were people that were saying it was better than V for Vendetta. You know, like that. And honestly, it's not better than V for Vendetta. And you know what? Carl Urban does a good job in it. But the problem is, they played this serious. They did. They played the movie serious. All right. And you need a little bit of whimsy here.
Hold on. Just for the audience. For the audience. You know, sometimes you're going to have to do this. Explain who is Judge Dredd. Explain the character and then go more into this particular, this new reboot.
Okay. Essentially, on a future time, all right, cops are given license to be judge, jury, and executioner, all right, when they're carrying out their things, okay? And essentially, that's what Judge Dredd is, okay? He's a cop with full sanction, all right? He's the Punisher with a badge. He has to operate within the rules of the law, but he can blow you away. So don't jaywalk. Don't steal a purse. Don't. If he's having a bad day, you're dead. Let's put it that way. If you break the law and he's having a bad day, he could take you out and there'd be no repercussions. But,
so this is NYPD 2012. I'm sorry.
Not NYPD,
I joke. Go ahead, Darryl. Go ahead.
All right. So essentially, that's it. And he comes into a situation where there's a hint of a conspiracy behind some crimes being committed, and some judges are overstepping their bounds. But if you've seen the clips, I mean, overstepping your bounds in this movie, it's like Rainier Wolfcastle meets the Sylvester Stallone Judge Dredd. When I say overstepping my bounds, and from there, that's where the conflict is, as he's trying to resolve this in one of the most explosive ways possible. I mean, there are more explosions and gunfires in this one than the Expendables 2. I'll put it that way. But the problem is, I guess it's just for movie fatigue. You know, and when you put so much money behind it, you can't help but look at the figures as they come in, and you go like, okay, that didn't do well. And you brought up the perfect movie. And The Watch only cost $6 million to make. $6 million. It's got one of the Gyllenhaals in it, okay? And it's a crime drama. I think this happened before with, I forget what was up against Training Day, but there was a sci-fi movie that was up against Training Day. And they put a big budget behind it, and Training Day was only made for like $14 million. It just goes to show that, you know, sci-fi isn't taking over Hollywood, and the audience's moods are very fickle. You can't predict these things. And honestly, I often said it also, you know, hey, most of the big bucks going into the movie theaters right now are in the hands of teenage girls. And, excuse me, Judge Dredd, how does that appeal to teenage girls? Back to you, Afroner.
Yeah, going into the chat room with our friend of the show from the UK, Stanley Kubrick, he says, hey, Dredd was a great sci-fi shoot 'em up. It wasn't faithful to the 2000 AD British comic, i.e. no droids and vehicles, and that it should have been more futuristic. Now, what he's getting into, one can make the argument that the – I guess it came out in 95, 96, the Sylvester Stallone original version, that might have been more faithful to the comic, but that was known to be a colossal bomb, and hence that's why it took almost two decades to go to this version. So I think that – but I really think – because that one was so highly touted. I mean, everyone knows about that film. It's been seen on cable probably countless times. It's on VHS or DVD all this time. I think it has such an indelible impression, or left such an indelible impression on the audience. It's just hard to go. It's hard to go back. You know, I should say it's hard to go forward without thinking about that particular film. How much do you think that played a role in this not doing as well? On top of the fact that, as what Kubrick says, it just wasn't that futuristic in its appearance.
Yeah, it essentially was Punisher Warzone 2, Electric Boogaloo. That's what this was. But I'm not talking about as terms of the movie, but in the context you just described, when you went in to see Punisher Warzone, you couldn't help but compare it to the Thomas Jane Punisher. You know, you couldn't help. It was like, this one, hey, Carl Urban does a good job here, all right? And English critics are more to the point, and they love this movie, okay? I didn't love it as much as they did, but it was an okay movie. I could see what Stanley's saying about the lack of sci-fi features, because they played this real urban, real dark, real gritty, with the explosions essentially giving you the best lighting throughout this movie. And it also, in the back of my mind, because pictures of it got released, it makes me wonder about what's going to happen with RoboCop. You know, same type of tone, but they said it for the RoboCop, they're going to play it serious. They played this serious, and it did not work. How's the RoboCop going to do?
All right, you know what? I want to go to a quick musical break. And you know what? Since you brought up RoboCop, I don't think we actually talked about it. We did see some photographs of the new rebooted version of Officer Murphy. So I think that might be interesting to talk about, as well as I want to talk about Justice League Zero with Shazam's origin. They fleshed out his origin more completely in this.
Afro Shazam.
So I do want to talk about this a bit more. So let's get into it. This is Good Old Clyde. Good Old Clyde by MC Frontalot. We'll be back in a few moments. Let's groove.
That's how all the trouble started.
Okay, we're back again. You're listening to the best of our Grindhouse Sundays, courtesy of Afternoon Radio. This is the Comic Shop. That was Good Old Clyde. Good Old Clyde by MC Frontalot, giving you the best of nerdcore. Actually, nerdcore. I'm trying to emphasize nerdcore during the Comic Shop broadcast. Folks, feel free to give us a call. Don't be scared. The call-in number is 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. Before we went to the break, Darryl just offhandedly talked about his impressions of the costume of Officer Murphy. Officer Murphy from RoboCop. The first one came out around 1987, if I'm not mistaken. So now we're 20-plus years in the game, and they're looking into getting to this again. And I'm a little disappointed in his costume. What are your thoughts on this, Darryl? You brought this up. What are your thoughts on this rebooted version, the visuals on this new RoboCop?
Well, here it is. You know, we talk about when you're doing reboots, you know, you have to put your own stamp on this stuff, but you got to be true to the subject matter and yada yada yada. Okay? I'm paraphrasing and being a little spiteful as I say that. Hey, the first impressions are oftentimes the main impression, and the streamlined suit, I don't know. I really don't know. As a fan of the old series, you know, of the old movies, and I even watched the made for TV series. I didn't have a problem with a suit there. This essentially looks like they They grabbed one of the bodies from Blade Runner, painted it blue, and added like pads to the alongside the arms. That's what one of these look like. Again, that's first impression. We haven't seen anything outside of two or three photos, but wow. Back to you, man. Just wow.
All right. Again, this was looking for this to come out in 2013. Now, the one that came out in 87 was really futuristic for its time. It made sense. I mean, you're living, you do your art in the time that you exist. So in 1987, you know, with all the jabs at corporate America, you know, the commercials that were definitely reminiscent of current commercials of its day, current corporate commercialism of its day, but it was on steroids. It was more hyperbole, hyperbolic, and more more over the top, obviously, in 87. Now, in 2012, we're even more corporatized than we were 24 years ago, what have you, or 25 years ago. So my thinking is, you know, in looking at, you know, that's another thing too, Daryl. I think we might have glimmered at this on the show before. Because of the times that we're living in, we're such a highly technological race, I should say, or we're in a technological time. The movies almost can't catch up with real life technology. What I mean by that is it's almost a humorous discussion on other podcasts, other shows, where people are starting to realize that when they look at future, you know, sci-fi, dystopic future movies and films, TV shows, even if you look at the Terminator now, you know, 1984's Terminator, when it first came out, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger character, the android, he arrives and he goes to a payphone. You know, and you look at that, it's like you can't even look at a payphone in a futuristic movie now. Because we you know, it's dated. Now you would expect, I think they might have done this for the Sarah Connor thing, the Sarah Connor TV show. Realistically, if an android comes from the future to the past, he would, well, I guess it goes with what time you come into, but we're expecting him to internally have Wi-Fi capabilities where he wouldn't have to go to, I mean, that's how realistic it is. So when I look at this RoboCop in a metallic uniform, the reality is even now they're making androids that look very close to actual humans. I mean, we're getting very close to this thing. I've seen stuff on YouTube, Daryl, that we spoke about on AfroNerd. I've seen androids, even though it's very archaic at this point right now. It's very, you know, still at a base level, robotics. But even now, they're working on robotic forms that are almost indistinguishable, if they wanted it to be, from humans. So why does this guy still look like he's wearing some kind of battle uniform? The only saving grace I can say about this is directed by Jose Padilla, this new one. I'm looking at the roster of talent involved in this. This makes me think, all right, I'm going to, and I want you to get your impressions on this, Daryl, and the captain as well. I may have to, you know, maybe it's going to require some kind of green screen effect. I don't know what the deal with this costume is, but when you hear that Gary Oldman's in this thing, Sam Jackson, Jackie Earle Haley, Michael Keaton, speaking of Batman, Michael Keaton, can it be whack with this level of talent? Would they be attached to something like this? Maybe we're being a little too quick on the draw on this thing. What are your thoughts, Daryl, and then Captain?
Yeah, like I said, it's totally premature. That's what part of our job here is, to give our first opinion. And if it's great, you know, I'm one of the guys here that will always go back and say, you know what, I was totally wrong. And you know, but just the feeling from the suit, I go like, okay, I got to see action scenes with it because the suit looks awful. Go ahead, Cap.
Here's the problem. Here's the issue with this whole thing. All right? Now, this is what Hollywood is supposed to do. And they don't like to do this because a lot of times it works ass backwards, meaning which you can throw the glitz, the glamour, the special effects, and make everything else weak and the public does come out and see it. Not all the time, but sometimes it works, and sometimes it works very big. The first thing that they have to do here is come with a solid script. You come with a really good story, which is not that easy to do. It's much easier to put special effects and everything else around it. Do that first. Then you add in the great actors. Then you add in the special effects. If you do that every time out, how bad can the movie really be? It might not necessarily work where you make a ton load of money, because you could still miss. But sometimes the movie's good, and the people just don't go to see it. But that's the starting point. And then you really can't complain at that given point if they give you that. Now the question is, are they going to do it? Are they going to do that? You know, you listen to everything that we're tuning in on, where, you know, because that's what they gave you. You didn't get to see the script. Of course, you're not getting to see the script, of course. But we tune in on the uniform, how RoboCop looks. I don't know if we're going to like the special effects, the futuristic part. And that's part of the story. But the most important thing is having a really good script. If it's a really good story, and then we build everything around it, the movie won't be bad. It might not necessarily be a great movie. You know, that's what made Avatar so good, because the story was really good. Then we had the amazing effects in there. Incredible at the given time. Now, you know, here with RoboCop, my opinion at this point, and it is premature, just as the great Daryl says, it's 50-50. They could just totally mess it up because of what they like to do. But if you start from that standpoint, we will sit back here and say, well, you know, it didn't necessarily make money, but it was a decent movie because they built from that element standpoint. Back over to you, Sir Afflenerd.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Avatar because, from my understanding, the reason why they're even considering RoboCop as a 3D film, for the uninitiated, RoboCop, I think from this point they're submitting it to the audience as a 3D film. And they're doing it because of the success of Avatar. So that's one thing. That's a direct connection with Avatar. And also, Darren Aronofsky, a terrific, terrific. He did the Wrestler. Is that correct,
yes,
Daryl?
Yep.
He brought back what's his face from Iron Man.
Mickey Rourke.
Yeah, Mickey Rourke. He brought him back, and Mickey Rourke is a freak show right now. He used to have a leading man appeal, and now he's a character actor because he made himself look like a character. Anyway. I was far more intrigued about this when Aronofsky was attached to this, because you knew he would have definitely brought some depth to it. Now, I'm not really that familiar with Jose Padilla, although they're saying the reason why they opted out of Aronofsky and went toward Padilla, well, it's always about money, is because of the success that he had with The Elite Squad and The Elite Squad 2. They were commercially successful, so they decided to go in that direction. Now, I'm looking quickly. We're going to make a quick transition, but I do want to mention this just to be fair to Mr. Padilla. In his own words, maybe he's on to something. It's what he says. I'm uncomfortable with the suit. As I said before, not to be repetitive, but there should have been so much thought about thinking outside the box. You know, all it is it's an update of that suit. It shouldn't even be considered. It should have been a totally different thing, because we're in the reality where they would be making humanoid. I mean, he's already human. It would have been a true cyborg. Anyway, this is in the words of Padilla himself. He says, "The first thing that I have to say to you is this. Forget about the movie RoboCop, which is a great movie. Forget about the context in which it was released back in the 80s and the great asset criticism of the media that it made. Forget about all of that, just the concept of RoboCop theoretically. RoboCop is not a superhero. RoboCop is what happens to a man when you start changing it with technology so he can follow certain purposes and do certain things for corporations or whatever. What happens when technology takes over consciousness and free will? In 40 years, we will really be there. We will be able to. There's going to be robots all around us doing things, and they are doing things according to specific software programs designed by specific people with specific goals and criteria, like RoboCop is. And so it's a genius concept, and I embrace the concept of the film and the project just by the concept alone. Now, you are right. The environment nowadays is different than the environment in the 80s, and the way to explore the concept is different. And so we are doing something that is original and in its own terms, even though we have the same brilliant concept that RoboCop has. All right. they always say this, and then ultimately it could be a pile of poo-poo.
My rebuttal to him is, if you want us to forget about RoboCop, then why did you name the movie RoboCop? From that point, I tuned out everything else you're saying. You're telling me, forget about the past movie. Forget about it. RoboCop, that was a great movie for its time, but this ain't RoboCop. Cap, did they name this movie RoboCop? So, obviously, once you name the movie RoboCop, what are you going to compare it to? RoboCop. Thank you, Mr. Padilla. That's beautiful.
Wait a minute. In all fairness, though, you do have Battlestar Galactica. They renamed it Battlestar Galactica, but it wasn't the Battlestar Galactica that we know from Lorne Greene. So it doesn't stop it. If you rename the franchise, it doesn't stop it from being different, even though it's a different name.
But Ron Moore never came out and said, you know what, forget about the old Battlestar Galactica. Forget about it. It's gone. It was a good one for its time, but it's gone. This is Battlestar Galactica. That's what this guy just said. When you name something identical to something else and you're using the same themes of something that came out before, what man can turn off his brain to go like, you know what, I'm never once going to compare it to what it came before. You can't do that. We're all human. You are going to go back and remember the previous thing that had that name. And I'm sorry, Mr. Padilla. You named it RoboCop. You didn't name it Blade Runner. You didn't name it Future World. You know, you didn't name it another name. And rest in peace to Yul Brynner for bringing up a couple of his good movies. But once you name it RoboCop, you can't help but compare it to RoboCop. And it's not even out yet. We're only human.
You know, I'm not so sure on that. Only because Battlestar Galactica definitely broke that mold. I think we're going to have to wait on this one. I will say one thing. I want to defer to the captain because he sent me a quick note about nanotechnology. It made me think about this. Now, I want him to say something about the nanotech on this, and then I want to mention something that has happened in comic books for years regarding androids that might be the saving grace for this stupid battle suit that I see. What were you talking about as far as nanotech, Captain?
I think he should be a nanotechnology shape-shifting cop, being able to grow bigger and smaller, and things can come out, just as you will see in the new Iron Man, a situation like that, you know, and just base things off of that. That keeps it more futuristic, and it still stays with the same theme. I think it should go along the lines, and that would also hook the crowd in some. He can switch his appearance. So if you don't like that initial appearance, you switch into this. There's something that you're definitely going to like, and he can grow bigger. Maybe he grows up to like 10, 11 feet, 12 feet tall in a battle situation, and then maybe he also shrinks down a bit. He can get smaller via the nanotechnology. That's how you explain it, and the audience will be able to grab that understand that concept. Just food for thought.
I tell you something else. I tell you something that maybe you think about this. It made me think about the Vision, actually. Especially, this will get me interested. I may have to send a note to Mr. Padilla because he better do it this way. He better do it this way.
Your opinion is correct.
It is correct. Well, you understand what I'm getting. I've seen it in a comic book trope. It's a comic book trope, but it's a good comic book trope. And even the irascible, indefatigable Daryl B, the amazing, incredible, I'm using all these adjectives from the comic books, Daryl B, even he won't front on this. I dare to front on this concept. Okay, this suit sucks, right, in my opinion. But what would make him interesting is that, okay, you can't have this battle bot walking around if you're going to be a true robot. If he has a stealth mode or a mode where he's able to – no, listen. If he has a mode where he's able to give the appearance of a human because of the nanotech, right, where, you know, if he's going to do an undercover thing, on occasion, because if you want to be a real cop like this, effective. You got to have different modes. You got to be a shapeshifter. The Vision, you saw the Vision having the ability on occasion because he had the Simon Williams imprint, and all. I'm going in you know, deep lore here, but essentially to the audience, the Avengers Vision character, that android, because he was always, there was always a duality to him where he's always fighting his robotics as well as his quest for humanity. The perfect Pinocchio story. On occasion, he would go out to clubs. He would go out to clubs in human form. And you saw
Conducer.
Right. You saw how he was learning to be human that way. Now, what they should do in this film is, okay, we know he's robotic, but even the older iterations, you saw the internal fight that Officer Murphy had with this new robotic thing, but he was still a man inside. You still saw that. This way, because we got to be honest about, you know, it's 25 years later. Technology has moved ahead. You have to, the film has to adapt to the technology even in the day. It's, you know, it's meant to be a dystopic future, but we're in the future now. We are in the future. So what they should do is have this guy on occasion, you can tell he will play around with his ability to have the appearance of a human and interact. Maybe even establish some kind of romantic relationship where he has to pull back, obviously, but he finds himself falling into this costume, as it were. They need to go that way. There's got to be some addressing of nanotech where he can change his appearance, where he can walk around being human. He can't be RoboCop 24/7. If he's going to be a real cops go undercover. There's got to be a point where he's able to go undercover and change his head. The nanotech that was in Terminator 20 years ago did that. He's got to be able to do the same thing. What are your thoughts on that, Daryl?
Two things. It'd be funny if the computers used in Avengers and Iron Man look way better than the computers used in RoboCop, which is supposed to take place 40 years ahead of us. That's one. And two, sure, nanotechnology would work, like Robert Patrick or Christina Loken in the Terminator films, where they're able to change parts, pull out weapons, and all that. That's great. You're thinking they're thinking about this? I don't know, because obviously, from how Padilla made that statement, right? Maybe we're all being pranked by the pictures. Maybe they are thinking about this, but it's Hollywood. Cap, do we trust Hollywood?
Nope.
There it goes. I don't trust these guys to have thought about this. I think they saw the first RoboCop. Look, we'll tweak the script a little bit. We'll make it 3D. We'll get high-name actors in here, and we're going to tell the same story again, but yet it's not RoboCop because RoboCop happened then. We're just going to name it RoboCop. That's the point. Get over, son. I'm only human. Go ahead.
Listen, I'm going to go to another musical break. When we get back, I do want to talk about Justice League Zero, this reboot after a reboot. We already talked about DC 52, and then they pulled us back in. Just when we thought that we had enough, they pulled you back in. They're pulling us back in with this Zero. But I have to admit, I don't know if Daryl, because we don't always agree. We rarely agree. But I actually liked Justice League Zero because it was Shazam focused. I like this update. Maybe because I'm such a Gary Frank fan, that visually it was a visually stunning comic book, and I like the way they made Billy Batson more realistic as an orphan kid. This is my opinion. We'll get into this. One more thing before we go to the musical break. I'm looking at the poster for RoboCop. This is what makes me nervous. If you look at the poster, all you see is, like, I guess the holster, like his leg. I think it's his leg. And you see RoboCop, you know, you see the actual lettering of RoboCop. And it's matted black. It's got that, it looks like a Nissan car, like a car. It looks like an updated vehicle. That makes me nervous. It looks like RoboCop 2.0. That's what it, I mean. It's not, that's not what it should be. It should be a different, a retelling, or a true reboot, different. All right. Anyway, we can only hope. Mr. Padilla, expect my email or letter soon. I want to see. I better see technology. Do not try to urinate on my leg and tell me it's raining, sir. I'm just saying. All right. This is Slept on Tony. Slept on Tony by Doom Starks, MF Doom, and Ghostface. We'll be back. Let's groove.
Forced me to do evil. I created an anti suit to protect my people. Escape, vowed to be Iron Man the Great. The billionaire Tony Stark to renew your faith. Bill Stark Towers throw the biggest events. Got liquid armor, I can paint off this. Keep a few bad chicks, I ain't the average hero. Movie premieres, hit me with this now. Engineer 06-6 and letting go. Playboy industrialist, face of a ghost. Minds of a technologist, specialist. Modern day speed slang therapist. Specializing weapons I can blow on terrorists. So don't sleep, big homie. Recognizing I can see you, phony. My weak heart can't take it. Got a lifelong sentence. Boy, genius grown up, and I fight with a vengeance. I got steel toe wildings when I glide on stage, and my heart gently weeps in the iron rib cage. Punched by metals, replaced by elements. My enemies hunted like a tusk on an elephant. Extraordinary, hiding my dual identities. Anthony Stark, call me Tony, top pedigree. Multi-billionaire, military contractor. Crushing my opponents with the strength of a compactor. X Factor, I turn liquid to metals. Water to wild, I turn dirt into rose petals. Greatest man walking, blow a bottle of goose. Go from clad iron armor to Versace suits. I'm so elegant, scientifically intelligent. My lawyers won the case, I won't take the settlement. Money's irrelevant, I need heat to energize. Taking over the planet, stop in the process.
Giving the best of Nerdcore. That was Slept on Tony, MF Doom, and the great Ghostface. All right, we got about 6 minutes remaining, folks and gentlemen, so we have to make this quick. We might have to revisit this again next Sunday, but I do want to talk about it briefly. I have to admit that I really do like this new take or updated take on the Shazam / Captain Marvel character. I suspect that Daryl B. might have a different thought process on this. I thought that, Jeff Johns is the scribe on this story, and Gary Frank is the artist. Jesus, the artist on this thing. So it's visually stunning. I'm a big Gary Frank fan. It's just visually stunning. And actually, I was a little frustrated that up until now, he was always the second backstory recently in this new reboot, that it was the Justice League first, and then the second story was this reboot of Shazam. So now, with Justice League Zero, the entire book was devoted to at least us finally getting to the point where the character gains his powers. And it's fairly similar to the original story, where you have this orphan, Billy Batson, who goes into this cave. He takes a subway ride, he goes into this cave, and he meets this grand wizard, Shazam. And Shazam imparts his powers from the gods to Billy Batson. The only difference in this story is Billy Batson is really, he really is an orphan street kid. He has problems. The Billy Batson from the past was always this really true innocent. You know, he had all these circumstances around him, you know, sometimes homeless, living with under foster care, no parents, but he still remained positive and affable, which is cool. There's a part of that I like as well. He was very innocent. This one is not so innocent. And you actually see in this retelling that Shazam, the wizard, was like, well, this guy he's got problems. You know, he goes into his mind and he's able to actually see that he's good and bad. He's a human being. And even the part I found interesting, that Billy Batson himself, as a 15-year-old, schools the wizard. He says, listen, you're never going to find that perfect person to take these powers. We are a multifaceted beings. You know, we have issues. And when he explained it to him, and then when he went into Billy Batson's mind and said, and was able to see, he has the potential for good. I like that story. It's definitely updated. I don't know about calling him Shazam. I got used to him being called Captain Marvel, and he says Shazam. Now it's a little bit weirder. What are your thoughts on this, Darryl? We got about 3 minutes.
I'll just say it like this. One of the things with Billy Batson draws you to the character is his eternal optimism, right? He's an orphan, yeah, but the thing that made Captain Marvel stand out was his eternal optimism. You take away the eternal optimism, the way they made Billy Batson sound in this is just like that stupid freaking alpha kid in Amazing Spider-Man. I read it, and I like the Shazam. Okay, I thought, okay, that's a different thing, you know, and I like that. Okay, it's a more gritty thing, but the problem is when you fundamentally change the character, you change what the character is about. And the thing that made Captain Marvel stand out was he was a child, but he was eternally optimistic. And that's what endeared him to, like, Superman. That's what endeared him to Batman. That's what, even after they found out who Captain Marvel was, he was able to stand with them. This Captain Marvel, I don't know. I honestly don't know. Back to you, Lester Nerd.
Well, you know, I think there's some complexity here, though. I thought that you're still going to get your Billy Batson, because simply the part that really assured me of that is that he is outspoken as a 15-year-old, and he confronted the wizard, and he listen, ultimately, although he's a kid, the character, he is supposed to have a certain degree of wisdom. He has to be wise. You saw the glimmer of the wisdom element in him when he schooled the wizard. The wizard did not know. The wizard was passionate about finding this perfect person. And Billy Batson said to him forthrightly, you're never going to find this person. At 15, he said, you're never going to find this person. That's when I thought, wow, we're going to get something a little different on this one. I think we have to make room that these characters have to progress. All right, folks, we're going to have to go next door. We've got about a minute and a half remaining. Darryl B., you are much needed on the show. We know we battle, but it makes for great radio discussion. We're going to do it again, folks. Bear with us if you like. We're going next door to do After featuring Captain Kirk, where we're interviewing Lena Dawes, Ms. Lena Dawes. Hold on. Let's get to it. Any closing remarks, gentlemen?
Enjoy. Have fun. And be safe.
All right, Darryl. Appreciate it. Let's get out of here. Next door.
Spark with a beard?
I think not.
Anybody know who Willie Lynch was? Anybody? Raise your hand. No one? He was a vicious slave owner in the West Indies. The slave masters in the colony of Virginia were having trouble controlling their slaves, so they sent for Mr. Lynch to teach them his methods. The word lynching came from his last name. His methods were very simple, but they were diabolical. Keep the slave physically strong, but psychologically weak and dependent on the slave master. Keep the body, take the mind. I and every other professor on this campus are here to help you to find, take back, and keep your righteous mind. Because obviously, you have lost it.
Dearly beloved, we have gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you, there's something else.
Hawk, who goes yonder?
It is I, sire, Richard of Nottingham.
Well, speak up, man, what is it?
News from the east, sire. Rick the Ruler has returned.
It's abracadabra, a la baby professor. All hail funk and lesson. Sweet tongue, grand writer of scrolls. Now behold, let the legend unfold. Born in a cosmos where no time and space do exist. Vibe in the midst of the chaos. Mortals label me as a logic.
You're traveling to another radio show. A broadcast not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of the imagination. That's the on-air sign up ahead. Your next stop, Afro Nerd Radio, with your guide, Deeper, a.k.a. Afro Nerd.
Welcome, folks. Again, this is Grindhouse Sundays. You're listening to the second half, actually. This is after featuring Captain Kirk. The call-in number, 646-915-9620. Again, 646-915-9620. We have a special show for you tonight, folks. We're expecting author and music journalist Lena Dawes. She's coming through to discuss her latest work, literary effort, A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal. Well, actually, I got it backwards. What Are You Doing Here? That's the name of the book. What Are You Doing Here? A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal. And then after that, we're expecting friend of the show, Norman Kelly, to talk about this week's current events. First up, we have to groove. We're going to talk about rock music, black folk involved in rock music. So it would be apropos, since we do play urban alternative here, to play a little bit of black rock. This is Didn't See It, Sabata. Let's groove, folks.
Thank you.
Once again, I didn't see it. Sabata, courtesy of Afropunk. Folks, I always talk about this. Go to afropunk.com. Check it out. A lot of free music, free downloads, something different. Think outside the box. Think outside the monolith. That's why we invited this young lady to talk about her latest book, A Game. We're expecting Ms. Lena Dawes, author, music journalist, to discuss her book, What Are You Doing Here? Or I should say, What Are You Doing Here? It's a question. What are you doing here? A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal. So this would be a very enlightening and interesting conversation. And, of course, I could not have the conversation without my partner in White Collar Crime. Captain, you're needed on the bridge. Let's get to it.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no one has gone before.
Listen, regardless of whatever color you are, if you want to play Beethoven or Bach, classical music, by the way, in case you didn't know, Beethoven or Bach, or if you want to rock out and play heavy metal, or if you want to play rap, R&B, gospel, country music, whatever you want to do, you should be able to do it. And this is what Afro Nerd featuring Captain Kirk is all about. So let's get it started. There you have
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. You know, listen, I was actually perusing the Racialicious blog. Again, folks, I would definitely implore our listenership to go to Racialicious. And they have all kinds of interesting blog entries, articles, op-ed pieces, and they just happen to have a highlight of Ms. Dawes' new book, upcoming book. And anytime I see something that involves a black person going outside the monolith, thinking for herself, thinking for himself, I become intrigued. And that's one of the reasons why I started Afro Nerd. And, you know, when we were going through the email exchange and I was explaining myself to her and I told her I really wanted her on the show, there's actually she'll go into it, I guess, but she said that she just happened to mention our show in her book. So I have to give her a lot of respect for that. I definitely appreciate it. We both appreciate that. But, you know, she acknowledged that, you know, we had an interview a few years ago with Mr. Raymond Gale. Raymond Gale had a movie, which I believe is still available on YouTube. Folks, definitely check out this movie. It's called Electric Purgatory. And it talks about the life of these black rockers, the difficulty that they had in trying to break the mold. It talked about the history of rock and roll. So when I'm pretty sure she will talk about this as well. The fact that you have folks that of our own ethnicity, Captain, people of color, who will critique you, lambaste you, dissuade you from listening to music that's outside of the norm, that's out, or I should say, of the black norm, that you are supposed to listen to strictly rap music and R&B, and anything else outside of that is abnormal. So she is to be applauded for writing this book. And obviously I contacted her because simply I believe we are kindred spirits. I just got tired of pretending to like certain things that allegedly I'm not supposed to like. You know, we live in this country like everyone else, Captain. You know, we look at MTV, we go to McDonald's, we do all kinds of American things. There's going to be some overlap. So I just think it's important that we do get into this book and get into Ms. Dawes' scholarship, because I think what she's doing is important, and I just had to contact her. You know what, Captain? I think our guest, I'm looking out the window, and I think she might actually might be coming into the door right now. Let me just check. Ms. Dawes?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to Afternet Radio.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Oh, that's so nice.
You know something? I did not know that you were on the show before until I listened to that show that Raymond Gale was on. You were a caller from Canada. So I didn't realize who you were. So
that's okay.
You're back home. I didn't realize that it was you. Okay. All right. Listen, as I was telling our audience, I had to contact you. Anytime a black person, a person of color, does something that they're not supposed to do that goes against tropes and stereotypes, I must contact them. So when I heard about this book, I was in already. So explain to our audience, how did you arrive at this book? What made you, what was the impetus for you to write this book? What are you doing here, A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal? What made you do this?
Well, I guess first and foremost, I'm a metalhead. I've been a metalhead since I was probably 9, 10, 11. Like everybody of my generation, I was, just fell in love with, Kiss when I was 8. I don't know if anybody saw Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Opera. It was a terrible made-for-TV movie, and
yes,
I was really, and I just fell in love. I thought, oh, my goodness, I was sheltered, and, it was just these weird men wearing high heels and makeup, and I thought it was really cool. And then from there, I just got into, Judas Priest, Queensryche, some Black Sabbath, Deep Purple. So I've always really been interested in heavy metal, and I always wanted to be a journalist. I always wanted to be a photographer. I just wanted to be part of that scene. But as a black girl growing up in the 70s and 80s in, a small town in Ontario, Canada, I just never thought I could do it. So, as I got older, I started writing. I started with doing a lot of race and ethnocultural relations, op-eds, a lot of rants. Finally got into writing about music, got really bored of hip hop after about a year, and just decided to start writing about more alternative and rock music. So what happened was in 2005, I met a wonderful man who's still my friend, Phil Freeman, who used to be the editor at Metal Edge in New York. And I met him at a conference, and I had done a presentation on black women in rock and roll. And from there, I wrote an essay in 2007 that was published on Skin from Skunk and Nancy because she meant a lot to me. And from there, it was suggested by my publisher, Ian Christ, who runs Bazillion Points out of Brooklyn, holla, to actually take my idea of doing a documentary on black women in metal and put it into a book. So that's basically how I came across the idea, and it took me about 3 to 4 years to put it together and to streamline it, but that's where the book is at right now.
Full disclosure, I wouldn't consider myself a metalhead. I don't know if I've made that transition yet. Let me explain myself. I grew up with jazz rock fusion initially.
Mm-hmm.
Spyro Gyra, Chick Corea, Weather Report, the Yellow Jackets, that type of music. And then at some point, the video game craze came around, and I had a friend that was consistently playing Van Halen, The Police, Led Zeppelin, what is the band? Neil Peart, the drummer. Rush. Yeah, how could I forget that? Rush. So I heard a lot of that in the background. So it was permeating into my consciousness. So it wasn't hard for me. Then I became a Prince fan at some point, Prince supporter. So it wasn't hard for me to make the transition to jazz rock fusion, to classic rock, blues, all that it is related. Now, during the 80s, of course, we've had our full spell of hair bands. Poison.
Right.
All those groups. Now, I remember seeing some of these videos in the 80s. You could not see a black person in the audience at that time. Mm-hmm. Were you in that crew at that point? Were you really the lone, the fly in milk, as it were?
Yeah, you know, at that time I was not a hair metal fan at all, and it always did bother me. I mean, growing up in a small town where I was usually, I mean, there was 5 black people in my high school. So it wasn't that there was no black people when you saw the videos. It was just the fact that that genre of metal didn't resonate to me. At that time, I was actually going backwards. I was actually discovering, like delving into the Judas Priest back collection, going back to Stained Glass, or, you know, and going back into old, you know, Black Sabbath. So I was kind of going back into the late 60s, 70s of metal because I like harder music, and the hair metal to me was more of pop music. And it was also very confusing where, you know, like men with the fluffed up hair and the makeup, to me, I just thought, well, they're trying to, you know, get that demographic of young white girls. Because it seems like when it comes to, you know, the teen pop sensations like Justin Bieber or Justin Timberlake, you know, women like men who look like, you know, have those feminine features because they're not seen as dangerous or as risky, you know, and so they can relate more to that. So for me personally, I just wasn't into that at all. So that era was also where we had some really good punk, like, you know, The Clash was around, Violent Femmes. I was listening to a lot of, like, punk that was coming out of England at that time. So it was actually a great decade for music, and especially Metallica. I mean, I think also Metallica was the saving grace of the 80s. Ride the Lightning, you know, that stuff came out, and that kind of saved us metalheads who didn't like the hair metal. We were looking for something that was more, you know, pure and real. There are a lot of, you know, documentaries that have come out in the last couple of years about the 80s, and it's amazing how many awesome bands got looked over, like, you know, Anthrax, Testament. There was really thrash, like the Bay Area thrash metal scene was hot in the 80s, but that really gets ignored because when you talk about the 80s, most people are talking about Poison or, you know, early Motley Crue and that type of thing where, you know, that was what was on MTV. Testament was not on MTV at that time.
Captain, I believe you have a question.
Yes, hi. How's it going? Captain here speaking.
Hey, how's it going?
Tremendous, tremendous, my dear, tremendous. Okay. Being a double minority in this genre of music, meaning which being a black woman and, you know, being black, you know, of course, how did black males take to your passion for this music, black males particularly?
Not good. really not good. I mean, I write about it in the book, actually. You know, the first chapter is basically on my, you know, my discovery, you know, being a kid, you know, in that era and, you know, being a fan. And I found that when I got into my teens, when I started dating, I had a number of black boyfriends who really had an issue with the music that I listened to. Oh, you think you're white? You know, and in Canada also, there's a great impetus for black Canadians here to be involved. Most of our families are from the Caribbean. So reggae music, soca music, calypso music was kind of our hip-hop in terms of that listening to that music and being involved in that culture was perceived as your black identity. So I was adopted. My family is white. So that was another strike against me in terms of I didn't grow up with the music in the house, and I personally just didn't like it. So for me being wearing my metal T-shirts and you know, at one point, I think I probably had green and purple hair or whatever. That was a real issue. So I felt that, you know, and I was kind of also having some identity problems of, you know, am I black? Am I really black? And I wanted to be I wanted to, you know, have my black friends and do, you know, I'm very interested in social justice and race issues. I've always have been. But it was very, very difficult to be accepted within black communities as a metal fan, because that was also, that was what got me through, you know, a very difficult childhood. And that's what got, that's what kept my sanity going, was metal music. So I wasn't exactly going to give that up. So to make a long story short, yeah, there is an issue with black men. You know, I have a lot of black male friends as an adult who are begrudgingly accepting of what I do. But I think that it was a real problem when I was younger.
Wow.
Okay. Well, you're on the right show tonight, because a lot of people sometimes have an issue with us because we open up other lanes, to tell you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality of it.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you something. One of my things, I feel that the music industry in general is in trouble. It has been in trouble for a long time now. There's no more physical product to purchase, per se. Now it's ether. You can go online and download this stuff. So, you know, one of the reasons why I started pursuing at least classic rock was because I felt that there's such a dearth on the black music side. Artistically, it's so formulaic. I mean, well, really, pop music in general has become so formulaic that there's very little room for experimentation, that we're not really listening to, at least commercially. I mean, there's people out there that you have to dig for. We try to impart this musicianship on our show. But if you try to go to commercial radio and listen to this kind of stuff, it's very difficult. Do you think that things are changing a little bit, that there's more of a vocalization from folks like ourselves that say, hey, listen, blackness is supposed to be a lot more diverse than this? Do you think it's more of a pushback now than it was maybe years ago when you were younger?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, if you look at – I mean, I was just at Afropunk. Well, I mean, Afropunk's not the greatest example. But, you know, I was at Afropunk Festival a few weeks ago. I was covering it for a magazine, and there's a lot, it was just, you know, I guess aesthetically and looking at the crowd, it was just awesome. I mean, there was so many weird looking black people. I just felt at home, you know. On the other hand, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about Afropunk because the music, I really had an issue with where were the punk rock musicians, where were the metal musicians? They had Janelle Monáe play, they had Erykah Badu play, and I love those two artists, but I didn't fly from Toronto to New York to see them at Afropunk. So I think that in some ways it was, you know, they're black people. I mean, we're so diverse as people, and it was great to see the individuality in terms of, you know, what people were wearing and tattoos and piercings and hair and all that stuff. But it did concern me because the music that was played at that festival was purposely palatable. There was two bands, Cerebral Ballsy, which is from Brooklyn, and my homegirl, Alexis Brown's band, Straight Line Stitch, who are from Tennessee. Those were the hardest bands on the two-day festival, and I was really happy that both of them were there. But from talking to people in the crowd, there was a number of disgruntled brothers and sisters who were like, look, I know a lot of black metal bands who are playing in Brooklyn. I know a lot of punk bands who are playing in Brooklyn. Why are they not on the stage? And it was, you know, I mean, nobody, when you do these free festivals, you can never make everyone happy. And I think Afropunk does a wonderful job. But I was asking myself the same thing. But people, I also got the feeling that there were people who were there who wanted to dress freaky, but they were not into the music. So I think that there still is this tie between racial authenticity, racial legitimacy, and the music you listen to. People don't want to, I mean, they want to look a certain way because it's cool and you know, hip, but they're not necessarily going home and really looking at what other genres of music that are out there that they might enjoy. And I did kind of walk away with that, you know, a little bit of disappointment because I didn't quite think that they really got it. You know, back in the 2003 when Afropunk did their documentary, the bands that were featured in that documentary and my girl Tamar Kali, who's still going strong, representing Brooklyn, I mean, that is the music that I think that music is something different and something unique. And they took real risks trying to make a career out of playing that music. And I don't know that we've necessarily gone to that point where we can really, you know, people, teenage kids are, you know, whether they're really going to go and pick up the new Mastodon record or whatever. I mean, there are kids out there that are doing it, but not enough because we still have these ties like, I'm not really black if I listen to this, or my friends are going to make fun of me because I listen to this. And everybody wants to belong and everybody wants to be accepted, but there's still that resistance in terms of delving into different genres of music because you as an individual are passionate about it versus what other people think.
Yeah, you know, I was an Afropunk myself, and I have to confess, I mean, I had that same feeling in the sense that I was welcoming of the aesthetic and of the feeling that this is something different. But there were a lot of groups, as you just stated, that were not truly of the Afropunk intent. And I think that, I suspect that's why James Spooner is not really involved with, just to the listening audience, James Spooner was the gentleman that actually was the documentarian for Afropunk 10 years ago. And I believe someone else has taken the helm of it, and now it's kind of a mishmash of different groups. I know, as you mentioned, Cerebral Ballsy, Drez's son from the hip-hop group years ago, he was there, and I saw that performance as well. So I enjoyed it, but as you stated, Tamar Kali is bad. She is bad. She would have been an excellent, and she's a staple there. Although Janelle Monae has been there a few years too, so I think she represents on a certain level. But I think it's a work in progress, to be honest with you. I think it's a work in progress.
Sorry to interrupt, but I don't know if I necessarily buy that it's a work in progress. There are bands out there that can be, and there's good bands that are out there that deserve to be on that stage. I think they're just too either lazy to find these bands, or they can't have it too heavy, or the sponsors won't come. And I think that, I mean, it was wonderful that they had Nike and, you know, Smartwater and whoever else sponsoring the festival, but I think that if it got a little bit too aggressive and a little bit too heavy, the population that were there, it would be cut in half, and B, you might not get those sponsors. So they like being a little freaky, but they don't want to go all the way. There's a band.
I was going to say, Ms. Dawes, unfortunately, we only have about a minute for this segment. I'm going to have to bring you back, unfortunately.
Oh, no problem.
I'm going to have to bring you back. I do want to open. I'm going to try to get one caller in, and then I'll contact you behind the scenes. Unfortunately, Sundays, everything is pretty much – there's a lot of questions I didn't even get a chance to ask you, so my apologies for that. Let's open up the lines for one more question, and let's see. Did that person just pop off, Captain? Oh, yeah, okay, let me open up the lines and see if this person can come in, and we'll get one question, then we're going to have to revisit this again. Hold on one second, Ms. Dawes. Okay, caller, welcome to Affluent Radio. Tell us who you are and where you're calling from, 202. Hello?
All right. Esmond?
Norman?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay. All right. Hold on one second, sir. We'll be right with you just one moment. Sorry about that. All right. There was actually another caller that came in. I guess they bounced off. They got scurred, as they say. Ms. Dawes, it's been an absolute pleasure. My apologies. There's a lot of questions I had to ask you. We didn't even get into everything I wanted to ask you. But Sunday's
problem.
So if you wouldn't mind, I have to give you thanks for even mentioning us in your book. So that alone, I have to give you kudos for that. So we will have to revisit you. I'll definitely give you a call, a contact behind the scenes, because I want to do a part two with you on this. So
okay, well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, listen, we appreciate it. We're kindred spirits, and keep on rocking.
Great. Thank you.
I contact you behind the scenes for part two.
Okay. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Thank you.
Okay.
That was Lena Dawes. She has a new book called What Are You Doing Here? A Black Woman's Life and Liberation in Heavy Metal. And we're going to do a part two with her because there's just so many things we didn't get a chance to really dig into. So, Captain, I think we should take a quick, and I do mean quick, musical break. Then we're going to talk about, for the second half, we're going to have a current events sound off with Mr. Norman Kelly, friend of the show now. We had him on a couple of times, a noted author. And, his appearances have been so highly regarded, and so many people have come in because of his appearance. We thought we'd bring him back as on a regular to discuss weekly events, politics. So, Captain, what do you think about Ms. Dawes while I find this quick record? Captain, are you there? What are your thoughts? If I'm segueing to a quick song, what are your thoughts on Ms. Dawes, her appearance? We're going to have to get her back on for round two.
Oh, she's tremendous. She needed an hour. She's tremendous. She's a great speaker. She just flows. She wants to talk. That's the type of people we like to have on this type of show. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. All right. You know what? Speaking, keeping in tune with the rock genre, let's play this legendary band. They've come back into the fold, actually. I played them a couple of times before. They might have been the creators of punk music. Black folk, Captain. The group is called Death. And since we're going to talk about politics, this short song is called Politicians in My Eyes. Politicians in My Eyes. Let's groove. We'll be back with Mr. Norman Kelly. Hold on. That was Death, legendary punk group, and Politicians in My Eyes, and it would be apropos to bring in friend of the show, Mr. Norman Kelly.
Oh.
Norman, welcome back.
Hi. Thank you.
We appreciate you coming back. We appreciate your knowledge, sir, and your appearances on the show have been heavily touted, so we kind of had to bring you back. So we appreciate you coming through.
Well, thanks for having me.
we're going to be all around the map on this one a little bit. And I want to talk about, first up, just briefly, I don't know if you saw the trailer before we get into politics, although this is somewhat political for me. Jackie Robinson, the Jackie Robinson biopic.
Yes, I did see it. I have seen it. I saw it a couple of days ago.
What are your thoughts on this thing? Well, you know what? Let's play the trailer so folks know what I'm talking about. It's about a minute. This is 42. But from my understanding, I thought that Spike Lee was going to helm this thing. Once I saw this, I knew it was not a 40 Acres and a Mule works. Just knew it right away. So let's listen to this trailer, and then I want to get your opinion on
it. After the disaster of Red Hook Summer, thank God.
I kind of agree with you on that. Let's listen to 42, and then we'll open it up. Hold on.
I don't know who he is. Where he is, but he's coming.
World's not so simple anymore. I guess it never was. We ignored it. Now we can't.
Brooklyn, 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 we go hard.
You Jackie Robinson?
We go hard.
I father, I Brooklyn Dodger them. I Jack, I Rob, I spin. Oh man, I'm Jackie Robinson. But when I run base, I dodge the pen.
Want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back?
No, I want a player who's got the guts not to fight back.
You give me a uniform, you give me a number on my back, and I'll give you the guts.
All right, enough of that. I think we get the gist. Norman, your thoughts on this trailer?
Well, I don't have a problem with them playing Jay-Z's music per se, because you know it's anachronistic. But on the other hand, you know, usually what they do in trailers, the music that are in trailers are not necessarily in the film. And okay, you have that, and then. It also, it brings in a younger group of people who kind of know of Jackie Robinson, but may not really care about Jackie Robinson. And also, the song puts Brooklyn up front. And, you know, Jackie Robinson came to play for, like, the Brooklyn Dodgers. So, you know, like anything else in marketing, it's just a way of attracting attention. I mean, that's how I basically looked at it.
You know, maybe I've been accused of being an elitist, but you know, I like the way it looks visually. It caught me in visually, but it's something off-putting, and that's nothing against Jay-Z per se.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, 1947, it's
well,
a period movie.
You,
I mean, we've seen not to racialize everything, but we've seen a number of
It's a racial movie. I mean, Desmond, it is a racial movie.
But yeah, right. But what I'm saying is racializing it as far as from a contemporary perspective. What I'm saying is, you know, we've seen plenty of period pieces with white heroes, and they're not playing Judas Priest. Well, we're talking to Judas Priest. You're not hearing Judas Priest or something new. You're not going to hear Green Day.
Okay,
you're not going to hear Green Day in a Lincoln film.
Do you remember the late Heath Ledger?
Of course.
Of course.
Okay. He was in a film called, I forgot what it was called, it's something about being a knight. I forgot what the name of the film was called. Wait a minute. And that whole film concept was based on playing contemporary music. Now, granted, his character was not a well-known knight like Sir Lancelot. But the whole premise of the music was playing, if you've ever seen this movie, was playing contemporary rock songs in that movie. So it's not anything unusual for people to kind of like mess around with time frames in regard to like contemporary music. As a matter of fact, there was a film not too long ago by, I think, Sofia Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola's daughter, in which it was about Marie Antoinette. And I think the controversy about that was that the music in it was contemporary.
Maybe that seems to be more of a stylistic decision, though, or a theme.
That stylistic decision in this one.
Yeah. Kathy,
you have
a question.
I'm not even, I don't particularly care for Jay-Z. I mean, I don't like the sound of his voice. I tend to be more like a Tupac or a Snoop Dogg, and I consider Snoop Dogg in regard to his pimpology sort of like a guilty pleasure. But yeah, and like I said, I'm not a Jay-Z fan by any stretch of the matter. But you know, I really don't have a bone to pick about this in regard to them using him for this man. I mean, I'll go. It didn't turn me off. I'll go and see the movie.
Right.
And I'm glad Spike Lee isn't doing it.
Yeah, I have to confess that his Red Hook Brooklyn, I've only seen a part of the film, but
yeah, I saw the whole thing.
It's not a good movie. Captain, you have a question.
Well, I'm just going to comment briefly, and I have a tendency. I'm feeling exactly what Sir Norman is feeling to a certain extent. The pure side in me says that it's a period movie. It should be definitely this way. But I do understand with bringing in a Jay-Z, it brings in definitely a younger audience who would not normally see the movie, who may not even know who Jackie Robinson is in any way, shape, or form, but they know who Jay-Z is. So they hear something a little catchy. They can be inclined to bring it in, to bring themselves in, and go check out the movie. And I also know a lot of times when you're making these decisions, when you want to put together your trailer, it's not actually you yourself that's making that decision, the person who made the movie. It's someone else at the top says, this is the way it has to be. It's the marketing. It's the promotion. So you have all those factors going into it. So I might be on the same page with Sir Norman.
All right. We have a caller, actually. Let's open up the lines, and let's be fair. Let's see what the John Q. Public has to say. Let's get into it. Okay, caller, welcome to Afternoon Radio. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, 312. What's up?
No, it's Sergio.
Oh, sir.
How you doing?
What's up?
Hey,
pretty
sir,
good.
How's it
yeah.
going?
Yeah, all of you, what you guys said is right. You know, it's more of a marketing move than anything else. You know, show you how out of it I am. I didn't even know it was Jay-Z, you know. But we posted it on Shadow and Act yesterday, and it's gotten a lot of comments so far. It seems to be the slight majority of people don't like it, using the music. But then again, it's a marketing ploy, as you said. You know, they got to get young people in to see the picture. How much you want to bet that most of them don't even know who Jackie Robinson is?
Oh, God.
Yeah, I would be surprised about that also. Hey, wait a minute. Sergio, are you with Shadow and Act?
Yeah,
he
I'm just saying Sergio.
Are you with Shadow and Act?
Kind of?
I mean,
no,
are
I am the guy.
No, he is Shadow
yeah,
and Act.
Oh. Wow, hey, man, look, I just stumbled into Shadow and Act on IndieWire a couple of months ago, and I want to say hats off to you folks there. I go to that thing like I go to the New York Times.
Well, thank you. Yes, I know, I'm the one who, right? I'm the one who writes all the root stuff to get people upset.
Oh, that's okay. You're supposed to get people upset.
Yeah, right. I'm supposed to get people upset. I really wish I could have called earlier when a woman called in because, you know, with my classical music show, I think in some way we have a lot in common.
We're going to have her back for round two, actually. We're going to have her back for round two because these Sundays get a little tight, unfortunately. But, Sergio, you're being a bit modest. You know, he is a noted film critic in Chi-Town, so his work at Shadow and Act, it is great. Him and other his colleagues over there, they do wondrous work over there at Shadow and Act. I love the blog. Excellent blog.
No, Sergio, I often leave my name as No on it. I comment as N-O.
Oh, you're No. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've noticed your comments. Absolutely. Right. Didn't I say something recently you didn't like?
I can't remember. What was it?
I said something. I remember that. You know, and I said, who's this guy I know who didn't care what I said?
No. You know what it could have been? It could have. Did you make a comment about 2016?
Yes, I did. I wrote that piece. I wrote the piece about the producer of the movie who claimed that the film wasn't racist.
Yeah.
And
I wrote the piece, basically calling him
a hypocrite. That's basically what it all was about.
I think you, if I remember correctly, not unless it was somebody else, that you kind of just went off on the guy. But you really didn't break it. I mean, I just thought it was a missed opportunity for you to use your expertise to really go through that thing and just break it down.
Here's the thing. It wasn't a review. You know, as some people comment, this is a terrible review. It's not a review. I didn't see the picture. I don't want to see the film. It was not a review. I was simply commenting on what this guy said, you know, about... The film was not racist. And on top of that, I have at least two friends who have seen the picture, and they told me in detail all about it, right? But it was not a review. I have written reviews on the site. Believe me, you know a review when you see it. This was
right.
Not a review.
No, okay. I can understand it from that perspective. I'm just saying that given the platform that you have, it was a missed opportunity. You could have, just really ripped the shreds out of this guy.
Someone else did an earlier piece on the film.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember who it was now. But someone else wrote an earlier piece on the movie. They got a ton of comments. So, you know, I wasn't going to, you know, what could I add to the
yourself.
Picture?
Yeah.
Right,
well, listen,
that's what she said.
Look, I just don't say
but when this when
great.
I read
Shadow
this guy
Act
with his
great.
Comments
gentlemen,
no,
gentlemen
you guys are great. I love what you guys do for African American and diaspora filmmaking. I mean, it's the best thing I've ever read and seen, and IndieWire to me is great. So that's a minor complaint, so just keep on doing what you guys are doing. It's great.
Gentlemen, we got about 11 minutes remaining, so I got to make a quick transition.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Desmond. We'd like to
that's all right.
The show for about
it's okay.
5 minutes.
It's all right. And we're going to have you back, Norman, in 2 weeks because we got 11 minutes. So we're going to try to make the best of 11 minutes. Make the best of your time. Sergio, I want you to stay online. You're a friend of the show, so that's fine.
All right.
I know you're chomping at the bit about this stuff. Let's make a quick transition into the current political season. I really wanted you on a few weeks ago, Norman, when this whole thing with the DNC 1 week, the RNC RNC 1 week, DNC the following week. Quickly, what were your impressions of both performances? I put performances in quotes because that's what they were.
Well,
both
it's hard for me to comment because I, number one, I didn't watch them. No. Step back. I did watch Obama the last night, and I did watch Bill Clinton the night before. But you touch upon an important word, the word performance. The reason why I tend not to watch these things anymore because, number one, there's no real news value in it. Number two, everything has been driven down to what Neil Postman said in his book, Amusing Ourselves to Death. Everything in American discourse about serious things has been driven down to entertainment and performance. Basically, I am just effing bored with this whole political campaign. American politics, presidential campaigns go on for too long, and every 4 years they become more and more shallower and shallower and more meaningless. I've never come across a more meaningless political campaign right now than watching these two parties duke it out over nothing in a lot of ways, because a lot of critical issues are not even being addressed. I mean, you don't basically hear these guys say nothing about what is going on climate-wise. It's all middle class this, middle class that, big government this, small government that. I mean, these are the same issues people have been fighting over for the past 40, 50 years, since 60 years, since 70 years now, since Roosevelt. And the earth is getting drier and the waters are rising.
Literally. The snow caps literally are melting. I think
that
they even mentioned that a few days ago.
Shrinking.
Well, you know what? I will confess, on some level, this is becoming more of a sports spectacle than ever. It is pseudo-intellectual pugilism. That's what I call it now. You're literally looking for the opening as if you're looking at some kind of boxing match.
Right.
It's like a boxing match.
Look, Atlantic Magazine just had an issue out by James Fowles about what to look for in the debates. And on the cover and all the photographs throughout the magazine are these two stand-ins for Obama and Romney slugging it out. You go online and try to find the cover of the Atlantic, and that's what's on the cover. These guys are like throwing haymakers and right crosses at each other. Basically, what should be going on now in American politics, rather than these debates, which are not really debates, these guys all just ought to get into a ring and just slug it out.
Well, you know what's so funny is that I've been paying close attention to MSNBC. MSNBC, I think, finally has actually outpaced Fox, and they seem
But you know why?
You know why? Because all the histrionics. Because the histrionics, their over-the-top delivery, they're literally doing the progressive version of Fox. They have their personality part worked out. CNN tries, they try to be impartial or give an impartial delivery, but with MSNBC, they have a bunch of kooks over there.
I forgot who the executive producer of the news or MSNBC is, but he basically said when somebody pointed out why aren't real news reporters getting jobs there rather than Al Sharpton, he just scoffed at the whole concept of having reporters. Why? Because reporters probably, in his purview, are going to be boring. He wants entertainers.
Nowadays. Who has the boringest show on MSNBC? The boringest show. I will tell you, because I stopped watching the show.
Perry? Is it Perry?
Perry has the boringest show on that show. And I wrote about it on Shannon Act, and I got creamed for it, but I stand by it. Why? Because she doesn't play for television. Television is about sound bites. It's about how do you take an idea and put it into 30 words or less. You know, what she does is she takes a subject and then she gets some professors on that's deaf, and then they'll discuss it to death in a very boring way. I watch MSNBC all the time. I must tell you, I like it. And the reason I like it is because, I'll be damned, it's entertaining, you know?
If you want news,
see, goes to CNN, or better, go to BBC.
Yes.
If you really want to know what's happening in the world, read the New York Times and watch the BBC World News on TV. That's what I look at when I want to get news, right?
No, yeah,
because
that's true. What about Chris Hayes is up then?
Hayes, that persnickety little guy with that annoying voice. He reminds me of the kind of guy you used to beat up in high school. You know,
King of verbosity, by the way. He talks to them. He's too smart for his own good. And I love smart people.
Right. They're smart, and then there's a guy who's smart, and, you know, he wants you to know it.
Yes.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know, and that's the kind of guy he is. Look at me. I'm so smart. That's why I used to kick his ass in high school.
So what's the critique of Al Sharpton?
Let me tell you something about Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton, I'll tell you what he is. Well, you can say he's a fraud, but what he is, this guy has been on TV for 30 years, when you think about it. He knows how to play the television.
He
That's my mother's favorite show. She loves Al Sharpton. you know, and you know, and but normally she wouldn't like him, but she likes the show, right? Because he gives it to them. With the guy who runs MSNBC, we figured out a long time ago, and you mentioned it. Let's just do what Fox is doing.
Oh yeah.
Let's give liberals and progressives a show. I mean, the best show they've got is Lawrence O'Donnell. Lawrence O'Donnell is terrific.
Oh.
But then Lawrence O'Donnell is a professional. He created the West Wing. He's a screenwriter. Right. He knows how to write. He knows how to play to the camera. I don't like Chris Matthews because he's a nutcase. You know. But it's
good
entertaining. It's good. That's exactly what it is. It's good TV. That's why CNN keeps struggling. If you look, I follow the ratings. You watch CNN. CNN is begging for viewers, right? They can't get viewers because personality to it.
So do you think they're going to make a decision at some point to go personality-wise?
You mean CNN?
Yeah, CNN.
CNN probably they're in a bind because they're afraid to go down that way, but then they may see no other choice. I mean, the biggest personality they have is Anderson Cooper. That's not much.
Right. Yeah, I was about to say, he ain't much. I mean, I like him as a journalist, but he's not a personality piece.
No, he's not.
Gentlemen, one quick thing.
We got about
3 minutes. So we're going to have to take this up in 2 weeks. But before we close out, there's a word that the captain and I use a lot. the word is comportment. The reason why I bring this word up is after Romney's performances in the last couple of weeks, does he have the comportment to be the president of the United States?
Absolutely
Romney has what I think is political autism. Remember what autism is, the inability to read social cues? I think Romney has political autism.
I couldn't have said it any better.
I think that's what he has. I've been telling people this. If you watch him and see his responses to things, how like he just doesn't get it, I think the man has autism. I think he has political autism.
Here's the question you got to think about Romney. Why does he want to be president? He hasn't given a single reason why he wants to be president except it's going to look good on his resume. He doesn't have any kind of fire in the belly to be it. It's just something he figures he ought to do, maybe to accomplish what his father didn't do. There's no reason for him. He has no reason to run, right? And I've been around. I'm sure I'm the oldest guy around. I've seen a lot of political campaigns. I've seen bad ones. This is horrible. This is about as bad as Dukakis. And I thought I would never see a campaign as bad as Dukakis.
Yeah, and that was pretty bad.
Yeah, that was as bad as Dukakis.
Gentlemen, we got about a minute. We're going to have to close the shop. Listen, we will reconvene. Sergio, you too. Reconvene 2 weeks. Next week we have Andre Simone. So I'm dusting off. I'm taking off the dust. Andre Simone's coming through next week. But the following week, Norman, I need you back. Sergio, you're always welcome. We'll reconvene for an hour, and we just get into it. We'll mix it up.
To our listening
audience, gentlemen, we appreciate your support. We'll get back to you. And we're going to close out with a Jammy Jam respect. Not Aretha Franklin, though. This is Minnie Riperton with Rotary Connection. I'm taking off the dust. Rotary Connection, respect. We'll see you guys and gals in 2 weeks. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, gentlemen.
All right. Bye, guys.
All right.
Bye.
All right.
What do you want? Baby, don't you know I got
baby, why you gone? I can't do you wrong, 'cause I don't wanna.
You lay my love.